I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. Most of the talk about education these days is about low test scores, high dropout rates, and the U.S. falling short compared to students in other industrialized countries. This is a serious problem, and it's something we've talked about on this show. Our guest, Dr. Madeline Levine, says she's concerned about students from affluent and ambitious families who put enormous pressure on their children to be the best. She wrote about them in 2006 in a book titled The Price of Privilege. Now she's back with a new one titled Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. She writes that it's time to value traits like empathy and resilience more than just getting into the best kindergarten or the best high school or the best college. Levine has a private practice in California. She's also a co-founder of Challenge Success. That's a research-based organization at Stanford School of Education. And Madeline Levine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Let's start with what's wrong with success. How do we misdefine success in this country? And then we'll talk about all the solutions that you put forth in your book. What's wrong with what we're doing now?
Okay, so it's not success that's wrong, or achievement, or high grades, or any of that. It's the way we're getting there, and what we think is important in that. So success that is bought at the cost of mental health, physical health, interpersonal relations, coping skills, all of that, is not really very successful. This is just an aside, I was so sad last night. When my kids were growing up, our favorite movie was Top Gun.
Yes.
Because you could easily recite the entire dialogue if you were 7 years old with your mother, which I did with my oldest kid. And, you know, and then you find out that Tony Scott suicided yesterday. And it made me just incredibly sad. Suicide's very complicated. But, you know, what looks like success, I think we've fallen into this idea that what looks like success, i.e., having a lot of money or a lot of celebrity, is the only way to think about success. And you know, I really want to suggest, as an adolescent therapist, that there's a much broader notion of success that serves kids in a much healthier way.
And just picking up on that, because I want to make sure our listeners understand your critique, not of success, but of the kind of pressure, I think, that high-achieving families put on their children. I guess the focus on grades, on making sure that resume is fleshed out, on applying to the best schools, on getting to be the head of the debating team. Is that the kind of pressure you see among your clientele?
It's the kind of pressure that I see, and it, you know, look, there are some kids for whom that works,
right.
But I'd suggest that's a very narrow, thin layer of America's children, and that for the majority of children, that kind of constant, you know, it's not that you have to be good at something, you have to be great at something. And, you know, I have mothers coming to the office and worrying that their child doesn't have a passion yet, and then I find out the child is five. So it's this very early, very accelerated, very pressured view on what it takes to be successful. And the fact is that child development's a pretty well-researched field. We have a good idea of what makes kids successful, and it's not very high levels of anxiety. It's not trying to do things outside of their developmental stage. And those are the things that are dangerous. So I really appreciate your opening question about, you know, is it success or is it the form that success is taking? Because, you know, the one place that I can sometimes get criticized is by people saying, oh, you're anti-intellectual or you're anti-success. And my answer, frankly, always is I'm a Jewish gal from New York City with a PhD married to what my family calls a real doctor. I'm not anti-success at all. But, I do see the cost of this incredibly unrealistic and out-of-sync developmentally pressure on kids.
Well, going back to that parent who said to you, I'm worried that my child doesn't have a passion yet, that child is 5 years old, where does that parental anxiety come from?
Many places, you know, like any shift in, I think, culture and social thinking, but primarily in culture, it's like vector forces, so there's many things that came together. I think somewhere in the 80s, when we had the dot-com boom and anybody could become a millionaire overnight. You know, you were taking stock tips from your stockbroker and your florist. Wall Street was a popular movie. This notion of overnight success sort of became iconic in terms of how we saw potential in this country. And at the same time, we had this sort of flip from Leave It to Beaver, Leave It to Beaver was earlier, type programming to The Simpsons or Beavis and Butthead, you know, where parents were idiots and kids kind of ruled the roost. So I think that happened, and now we have tremendous anxiety. Rightfully, we have tremendous anxiety. I have three kids who are entering, one's still in college, but two are entering the workforce, and you know, the fact is it's a terrible economy.
Yeah.
And so I think parents are really genuinely worried that if they don't give their kids a leg up, you know, they're going to end up sleeping in the basement and flipping burgers for the rest of their lives.
Do you think, though, some families have taken some of those ideas, even the business model, and brought it to the family so that, you know, it's great that a six-year-old knows how to read, but if a six-year-old can do it, let's see if the four-year-old can do it.
Well, okay, but, you know, here's partly where the research is incredibly useful. The sixth grader can read, doesn't matter if he's four or five or six or seven. Finland, you know, which is now the world's exemplar in education, doesn't even begin school until age seven. So our idea is that if we could just give our kids a leg up, are incredibly misplaced, and we have a whole body of research on this. So Baby Einstein, which was in one of every three houses in America over the last 20 years that had a baby or a toddler, has actually been shown to retard language acquisition, which is, you know, like shocking. But if you're thinking along the lines of child development, it makes perfect sense, because what makes a child learn how to read or speak? They're sitting on your lap, you're looking in their eyes, it's delicious and cozy, you know, they say mommy, your eyes light up, and you hug them a little tighter, and that's in line with how children learn to read. They're motivated by their connection. They're not motivated by watching a screen. And so at the end of the day, it actually retards language acquisition. Now, did anybody really know much about this? No, they didn't, and it was only 20 years after it came out, very recently, that Disney had to take the word educational off, offer an apology and a refund. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you didn't hear very much about it, because the resources of the University of Washington, where they did this study, is nothing compared to the resources of Disney. So we end up with a lot of misinformation that leads, I think, to some malpractice in parenting.
Well, you even talk, we're used to hearing about peer pressure among teenagers, for instance, but you say there's a lot of peer pressure that parents feel.
Tremendous peer pressure. You know, we're social animals, so the idea that peer pressure is an adolescent phenomena, it's just not right. It's a phenomena for us all of our lives, and I think what strikes me is sort of sad. I do an awful lot of speaking, and every place I go, at the end, you know, when I sign books or something, there's at least 20 people who come up to me and say, you know, I'm the only one in this community who gets it. And
it's lonely.
Right. And I'm just a salmon swimming upstream all by myself. What can I do? And it's kind of like, hey, you know, I just talked to 20 other moms who are feeling the exact same way. So you ought to get together. If homework is out of line with what we know is helpful homework, get together and go talk to the school administration because they know it better than anybody else. So I think parents are feeling very isolated in their concern. You know, I just had that an op-ed piece in the New York Times about some of these issues, and it turns out it got hit a million times.
I saw that.
Yeah, it's either the most or one of the most, they're looking at the numbers, emailed article ever. And it was simply, you know, the kinds of things we're talking about. But I think it is indicative of how lost people are feeling. You know, your mom doesn't live down the block. The rabbi or the priest doesn't stop by at the end of the day. Everything is a competition. And I think people are just feeling incredibly isolated and lost in terms of, you know, conflicting views about what's best for your child. And I think they would do well to pay attention to, you know, I'm down by Silicon Valley. So, you know, I know a lot of the Young Turks of Silicon Valley. And first of all, none of their kids are in... You know, they have the resources, but practically none of their kids are in regular schools. They're all in these kind of alternative schools that pay attention to what's known developmentally or about kids. So parents suffer over, should I send my child to an academic preschool? Will that help them get a leg up? Or just a play-based preschool? All these guys, because it's almost all guys, send their kids to the play-based preschool because the research is a child in a play-based preschool academically does much better down the line than an academic preschool.
Well, we're about a minute before our first break here, but do parents know, is it too much information, TMI?
What I'm saying?
No. The kind of pressure that the parents are under, which is that you read one study and you think, oh my goodness, I should do that. Then you read another study. Oh no, I should do that.
Well, it's TMI. It's too much information of the wrong kind. You know, the thing that I really wanted to do in Teach Your Children Well was to do a research-based book. I think. You know, somehow we've developed into having dozens and dozens of books based on opinion. I think this is better, or, you know, I spent a year in France, and that's a good book, but this is not an academic book by any means.
No.
It's, you know, talking to the neighbor next door. But it is entirely based on the research that we know about child development.
Well, let's take a very short break. I do want to pick up on some of that research and some of the advice that you offered. And again, Dr. Madeline Levine is our guest. Her new book is called Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success, Why Values and Coping Skills Matter More Than Grades, Trophies, or, quote, fat envelopes. 1-888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from the parents in our audience. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington supports WHYY. When someone is injured or ill, a long wait in the ER can be damaging. According to the Centers for Disease Control, average ER wait times are nearly 1 hour. St. Francis's Emergency Services team has worked to reduce the time to get patients into treatment rooms or to give them direct care to 30 minutes or less. More at stfrancishealthcare.org. At St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington, we specialize in you.
In 1977, bands like the Ramones, Talking Heads, and Television made New York's Lower East Side ground zero for American punk. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. In part two of our series on 1977, The Year Punk Broke, we take a look at punk stateside with music writer Ira Robbins. That's this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Deborah Ellis traveled to Afghanistan to ask a simple question. How do Afghanistan's women and children see their future?
These are great, courageous, amazing kids doing really incredible things with really difficult circumstances.
Ellis discusses their stories and her recently released book, Kids of Kabul, Living Bravely Through a Never-Ending War, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Madeline Levine about over-parenting, as she describes it, authentic success. She's a psychologist, a clinician, consultant, and educator with about 30 years of experience working with young people and their families. Her new book is Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Madeline, you have some very basic advice. Don't do for kids what they can do for themselves or almost do for themselves, and don't do for your kids out of your own needs. I think the last one is a little trickier to navigate and figure out. Can you expand on that?
Well, you know, I say it's the we're applying to Columbia or we're applying to Phillips Exeter or, you know, we're doing anything. It's when the pronouns get confused.
From you also, to we, right?
To we, right. And also, look, all of us have had disappointments and losses and, you know, reversals in our own lives. And is it natural to say, you know, I had a really hard time. I don't want that to happen to my kid. Of course. But it's, I think, when we project intensely, you know, I had that in the book. I have this story about this dad who's sitting in my office with his son, and yes, his son's a really bright kid, and he's going to go to a good school, and dad is just waiting and waiting for the word Harvard to come out of his kid's mouth. And when it finally does, you know, the dad jumps up and says, there's a school I would give my left testicle to get my son into. And, you know, the kid's face goes slack, and my jaw drops. And he's a good guy. I know this dad. He's a really good guy. But he's also one of four who didn't make it into Harvard, mm-hmm, of his three other brothers. And you know, that's an example of this kid had no interest in going to Harvard. He had a very different kind of agenda. And, you know, it's hard to stay away from wanting for our kids what we feel we missed in our own lives, but it's not particularly helpful. And, Marty, the other point that I just wanted to make, because I know we're going to take phone calls, is it doesn't really matter how, quote, successful your child is if they don't know how to make their way in the world. And, you know, I always say there's no success from a rehab bed. So you take these kids, and you can pressure a kid into compliance and maybe getting that B plus to an A minus, but you have to take a look at the cost in terms of what's being squeezed out of development. And I'd argue that if all our time and energy is spent on grades and how'd you do and do you need a tutor and are you going to make the traveling team, we lose the time that kids need at Challenge Success. We call it PDF, playtime, downtime, family time. And these are the things that make kids robust, that give them coping skills. We have to let them fail a little bit and still be around to make sure they're okay and learn how to pick themselves up. And, I mean, I've been around for a while. In real life, these are the most critical things you can have.
Well, let me pick up on some of that. And let me also quote something from the New York Times Magazine yesterday. You were quoted in there, wealthy parents today, and this is the writer, says are more likely to be emotionally distant from their children and at the same time to insist on high levels of achievement, a potentially toxic blend of influences that can create, and this is you here, intense feelings of shame and hopelessness in affluent children.
Okay, well, I didn't see that.
Oh, there you were. Does that sound like you?
Can you say it one more time for
me? Well, among wealthy parents, that I guess if you're emotionally distant from your children, but you also insist on high levels of achievement, that can create intense feelings of shame and hopelessness.
Right. So, yeah, it does. It's pretty. It's not soft, but it is definitely accurate. The research, the first book, The Price of Privilege, looked at why, you know, kids from upper middle class families were having such high rates of emotional problems, and they really were. They were 2 and 3 times the rates of the general population. And the research on that came from two sources. One was pressure to be, extremely successful. And the other was disconnection from family, which was, that was the much harder sell 6 years ago, because parents would say, what? You know, how can you say I'm disconnected? I'm driving you to your lacrosse practice and then to your coaching afterwards and then to whatever else, your preparation to go to the Sudan and do water treatment plants. I'm running all over the place with you. How can I be disconnected? But, you know, connection to me, I use the phrase an inviting, welcoming presence. And, you know, I had three kids. I know what it's like to be driving kids all over the place and you're going, what, you forgot your, cleats again? I'm not going back home. And you left your sweatshirt? Well, you're going to have to pay for that out of your allowance. And it's not an inviting, listening presence. And so these kids feel pressured. They feel disconnected, whether or not we do or not. And you put that together, and what you get are kids who constantly say, it's probably the most oft-repeated, there are two oft-repeated phrases in my office. One is, tell my mother to get a hobby besides me.
Oh, wow.
And the other one is, I'm only as good as my last performance. Mm. My parents are all over me, and I do well on the SATs or get good grades, and they're distant and disappointed when I don't do well. And, the fact is all of us have days where we don't do well, and it would sort of be, it would sort of suck, frankly, to come home on those bad days and have, your spouse or your kids waiting at the door saying, what, you didn't do a perfect interview, you better get on the ball there or else you're not going to do any more interviews. That, at that point where a kid is struggling with something, it's exactly where they need guidance and help and warmth and support.
Well, and I would assume, bottom line, kids, they want to please their parents, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so the parent needs to be pleased by the extraordinary uniqueness of that individual child. And that may be a child bound for Harvard, or that may be a child who doesn't go to college and goes to L.A. to learn the ropes of the movie industry, or that may be a child who loves mechanics and you want them to be a surgeon and they want to be a mechanic. It's their lives. And sure, we guide and have aspirations for our kids, but if those become more salient than the kids' own talents and interests, then there's a great disconnect. And, ultimately, Marty, at the end of the day, nothing matters more than maintaining the relationship between the parent and the child. Nothing.
And that's Dr. Madeline Levine. We're talking about her new book, Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. You may have read a book that she wrote a couple of years ago called The Price of Privilege. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Just to put a slightly happier face on what we're talking about, and I do want to get to our callers, what I got from your book, which is that if parents can teach their children empathy and resilience, that those are skills that can last a lifetime.
Right. And, it's not that I feel like kids are falling off the earth at this point. Most kids, and I think this is really important, most kids do fine. But a lot of kids don't. And we can't afford to lose, our tent has gotten too narrow. When I grew up, in that tent was the kid who was successful, was the kid academically successful, was the kid who was artistic, was the kid who was a great musician, was the kid who just had good social skills. And the tent has gotten smaller, the success tent. And now it's really inhabited only by academically talented kids. And I think we're missing incredibly creative, interesting kids who really belong in that tent, who are entitled to feel successful when they work hard at things that are, not AP chemistry.
Well, let me get some callers in, and I do want to talk about the role that schools are playing as well. But first, let's see what Janine from Windmore has to say. And Janine, go ahead, you're on Radio Times. Do we have her? No, we don't seem to have her. We will get some callers in. Let's talk about schools, because you have a lot to say about schools that they also, and this is, of course, speaking broadly, but I'm assuming we're talking about some of these high-achieving, maybe public/private schools.
Right.
That they, as you write, they focus on the wrong things. They give out too much homework. The testing matters too much. The focus on grades is too much.
Right.
And there's too much competition for college.
Right. So that's true, and it's so interesting. If I talk to a bunch of parents, right, a group of parents,
yeah,
then they point the finger at the schools. If I talk to the schools, they point the finger at the parents, saying, well, of course we know this stuff, but every time we try and back off, we've got parents screaming and yelling. And if I happen to be talking to both the school and the parents together, they all point their finger at the universities, and right?
Right.
And you know, it's kind of a useless exercise, because it's going to take all those things to change, to make a real shift. The schools should know better, but remember, a lot of the public schools are dependent on money from No Child Left Behind, on high performance, so there's tremendous pressures on parents. And there's also, like my organization, Challenge Success, we go in, look at the school. The school invites us. We don't advertise. We don't do anything. And the school invites us in and says, look, we're having a problem with cheating, or we're having too much homework, or too many of our kids need counseling services. What can we do? But many of these schools don't want it known that they're seeking this kind of help. And I mean, I think the dilemma is right there, where when my kids are 20 to 30, so when my oldest was growing up, if he was having trouble in whatever, you know, AP math, he was a good math student, it was very easy to, you know, call my neighbor and say, hey, Lauren's having a little trouble with something in math, you know, what do you think? And she could say, you know, well, my kid's doing fine in that segment. You know, do you want me to send him over and see if they can work it out together? Now, if you call your neighbor, this is what my parents tell me, and say, my kid is having trouble in a class, the answer typically is, well, I don't know why, because, you know, Johnny is doing perfectly fine in that class. So there isn't this sense of collaboration. And what's extraordinary about this to me is that business, when you ask them, or agencies, when you ask them what is the most important quality that a kid can have coming into the workforce now, it's always collaboration, because the world's problems are so complicated right now that you're going to have to work across time zones, across cultures, to be able to solve things. And we're still on this, you know, one kid, one desk, one grade model. And it's the wrong model for the 21st century.
Well, let me see. Let me try our phones again. We've got Mason from West Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Mason, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I had to repeat grade because I didn't score well on a placement when I switched schools. And that was definitely to me at that time. But 40 years later, I heard on the radio that parents are deliberately holding their children back a year.
Mm-hmm.
That gives them a leg up and teaches their children leadership skills, because they're the biggest, the tallest, you know,
right,
the fastest, the strongest, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, how does that play in? Because we're talking about giving your children a leg up. Is that a... you know, even though I wasn't deliberately held back, but all those things happened to me. I was the biggest, the tallest, the strongest, and so forth. And so a lot of my classmates looked up to me.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, I was the only African American in my class.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that feed into, you know, what you're
sure,
saying about, you know, giving your children a leg up?
Well, it's an interesting question, Mason. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Madeline Levine, go ahead.
Well, I'm assuming Mason was saying that he felt it gave him an advantage. Of course it's going to give you an advantage if you're a year older, because you've got a year more of cognitive development, social development. I think it's awful that the schools allow that as an option. School should start at 5. If that's when school in America starts, it starts at 5. And if you want a level playing field, all kids go to school, barring something, you know, extraordinary. All kids should be going to school. And I think it's part of the same issue of, you know, more, better, give your kid a leg up. And, you know, that's a temporary state of affairs for him to, in kindergarten, be 6 and be a big 6-year-old instead of a 5-year-old. He really should be with kids the same age as him. And then we end up with this notion that nobody's, like, really where they belong. Like, why do we have AP classes in high school? Those are college courses. Why do we hold kids back so they're sometimes 7 when they get into kindergarten and they're in school with 5-year-olds? You know, development follows a more or less predictable pattern, and we ought to let kids sort of live where they are in terms of what we're putting them into in the world. You know, we don't have to rush. You can have a robust, challenging high school course. Why does it need to be a college course? Why are we pushing kids? Childhood is, you know, fleeting and fast, and kids ought to be able to linger in it a little bit instead of constantly being pushed to the next level.
Mason, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Again, about a minute before our second break here, you, though, put a provocative question that I think that someone else had asked, but you included in your book, the question being, would you rather your child be smart or would you rather your child be smart or good?
Right.
Why is that an important question to think about?
Well, it was one that had me tied up in knots for many years, because the obvious answer is you want your child to be good. I think the obvious answer is, but it's not that simple. And it was my co-founder's. She started all her talks with that. I don't think they are mutually exclusive, but it's what's the dinner conversation about? You know, we had dinner together every single night, and my husband's a surgeon, and that sometimes meant that we had dinner at 9 o'clock at night. And you know, we know now that dinner 5 times a week is a very protective factor. We didn't know it back then. And people always assume that we had, like, extraordinary conversations about how we felt and what was going on. I had 3 sons, you know, getting 10 words out of them was a challenge. But when I think the message was, look, in this family, this is what we care about. How you doing? What's going on in your life? We never talked about school. We never talked about grades. We talked about the whole other part of life, which is character and coping skills.
And that's Madeline Levine, our guest today on Radio Times, author of a new book called Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. A full bank of calls here. We'll get more of them in on the conversation after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Where you go to know what's happening in the arts. From paintings to plays to pastries, Friday Arts celebrates local cultural expression, October 5th. Where you go to know tomorrow's greats today. Starting October 14th, On Stage at Curtis showcases powerful performers and captivating concerts. Where you go to know what inspires talented musicians. On Canvas features legends and up-and-comers, on stage and behind the curtain, starting October 18th. The new fall season on WHYY, where you go to know.
So I decided to jump out the window in my dream, and as it turns out, in my life.
Mike Birbiglia's Sleepwalk With Me has been a This American Life piece, a one-man show, and now a film which he co-wrote with Ira Glass. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with both. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Janice Abrams Spring's first book, After the Affair, has sold more than 500,000 copies and is considered to be the go-to book on extramarital affairs. The second edition is coming out with advice on how to handle illicit relationships in cyberspace. On the next Voices in the Family, we'll hear from Abrams Spring on issues of honesty, trust, and forgiveness after the affair. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Madeline Levine. She's a psychologist in private practice in California, co-founder of Challenge Success at Stanford School of Education, author of a new book called Teach Your Children Well. Let me get Mark from Downingtown to join our conversation. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to add to the conversation just a little bit of change of perspective, in the sense that when my children did well in school, the first thing I always said was, are you proud of yourself? Does this make you feel good inside? You know, how does this make you feel? And probably fourth or fifth down the line was, you know, I'm proud of you. And I always wanted to make sure that their success came from within. Their desire for success came from within, that they were pleasing themselves, because I think in the long run, that's the only thing that really carries through in high school and in college.
Well, Mark, those are interesting comments. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Madeline Levine, is that a good thing to do?
That's a great thing to do. Thank you, Mark. Mark makes a really, really important point, which is what's underneath the problems with telling your kids how great they are. And what's underneath that is the fact that they become very dependent on external motivation. And really what you want to be a lifelong learner and to feel that you own your own success is that it's internal. So always saying to kids, how do you feel? What was that like for you? What did you learn from the test? That's the way to go. Carol Dweck's work at Stanford is really, really clear that actually the less you have to say about your kids' accomplishments, the better. She takes two groups of kids, tells one group how smart they are, another group she says nothing to, and then gives them puzzles to do. And it's the group she said nothing to that does well, is more persistent, learns to solve more puzzles, becomes better students. Why? Because there isn't so much at risk. You haven't been told what a, you know, Picasso or Beethoven or genius you are. And the kids who are, where it's all this external motivation, there's too much at stake, because if they fail a puzzle, then they run the risk of being seen as stupid. Whereas the kids who didn't have that set up for them just enjoy the experience of playing and learning. So, like Mark said, you know, turn them back on themselves, and if you're going to praise effort and improvement, not outcome.
Mark, thanks for the call. Let's see what Carrie from Unionville has to say. Carrie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I just wanted to comment on a few things you guys talked about. I went to a very competitive high school, public high school, and there was a lot of pressure to do well on exams, to take all AP classes, and I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and the pressure got to me, and I struggled significantly in my sophomore year. And I understand the need. I can't really change the school system, but the one thing that I think maybe could be improved was there was a lot of shame in going to the school social worker or going to a therapist to get help. And I think maybe if there wasn't so much shame around struggling or shame around having to reach out and get help for dealing with all the pressures that we're under, and that could be something that needs to be more talked about, because I know that I would, my biggest anxiety during the day, along with everything else, was how would I enter the school therapist room without anyone seeing me, because I was just so ashamed that I was struggling so much.
Oh, wow. Carrie, I assume you went, and was it helpful to you once you got inside the door there?
It was. It was extremely helpful, and, you know, of course it's a long process dealing with what I was struggling with and my anxieties and being hard on myself, but it was something that I never wanted to talk about, something that I never wanted to admit I struggled with school. And I think especially being a young woman, you have to put up a front of, you know, behaving well and, you know, having everything in order, and I didn't, and I needed to get help for things. And it took a long time for me to be able to admit that I struggled, and I need to continue to take care of myself and not be so hard on myself.
Well, Carrie, yeah, I'm so glad that you called, and I know that Madeline Levine wants to respond to your call as well. Madeline, go ahead.
Carrie, how old are you?
I'm just turned 21.
21, so you're young.
Yes.
But since you've been in school, there have been even more cuts to mental health services, and you bring up such an important point, which is schools have all kinds of gadgets and doodads and technology and computers and not enough counselors. And I think at the moment, if there was anything that I think that we owe kids, it's to have a counselor, just like you're saying, available when they struggle. I'm in an upper middle class community with a school of 1,600 kids and 4 or 5 counselors, depending how you count it. That's 400 kids per counselor, which means that the kinds of service that you found helpful wasn't easily available. So the big picture is not being in a school where you're pressured so hard, and the intermediate solution would be having more people available who can help you when you run into trouble.
Carrie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. And Madeline, that really just underscores something that you both write in your book and we've been talking about on the air, which is just having someone to talk to that doesn't judge you about
Absolutely.
Your successes or your failures.
Before The Price of Privilege came out, I kept, my house was always sort of the hangout house, right? And which is a really great thing, parents, if you can, right? Because that way you get to see your kid in action, but you also get to see who they hang out with and all that kind of stuff. But for a while, when I was trying to take the temperature of kids, I had this sign-up sheet at the door, like you were allowed into the house if you just wrote one thing that you wanted to see changed. And so I had probably 70 kids making a comment on this sheet of paper, and I thought it would all be less homework or, you know, something like that. And there was plenty of less homework. But the most common comment was, my favorite one was, could I have 5 minutes a day to talk to a sane adult?
Oh, wow.
And, you know, obviously most of these kids' parents were sane, but kids need somebody besides their parents to talk to them. And I think sometimes parents feel threatened by that. They want to, you know, they're sort of CEOs, bottom line, you know, they want to be in control of their kids and can sometimes discourage that sane adult, that 5 minutes with a sane adult. But I think it's the best thing that a kid can have. Each one of my 3 sons had either a coach or a teacher, and that was their go-to person outside of the family. And somebody out there ought to write a book on the value of these coaches and teachers and other adults who stand in a child's life and accept them for who they are and encourage them, support them, are not as invested in their performance. That's a wonderful thing to have in your life.
Oh, Carrie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You raise a really important issue. And we have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Madeline, one of the things that you write in your book, and you talk about the kind of involvement but also the passivity of parents, and you seem to say you don't need to go to every single soccer game that your child plays. Did I read that right?
You did, and, you know, Here's the advantage of perspective. So with 3 boys, 2 of them were athletes, and that meant my husband and I every weekend for, I don't know, about 8 years went to different parts of California because they were both on traveling teams. I love sports. You know, sports are good. We have no obesity epidemic. Kids actually who are in sports do better than kids who aren't. I mean, it's got a lot to recommend it. But sports is supposed to be sort of a family event, and all it did was fracture my family every weekend. Mm. And I think that it models a very unappealing view of adulthood. So you work you know, you work your butt off all week long, you come home late, you're tired, and then on the weekend, the first thing you do is pack up and go watch a kid hit a ball. And you sit in the
bleachers. But it's your kid, though, isn't it, that's hitting that ball?
Well, yes, but does your kid actually need you to give up every Saturday morning for years on end to watch him hit a ball? I'm not saying don't watch your kid. It's fun, and it gives you a little bit of community, too, which we desperately need. But in retrospect, I would have used some of those Saturday mornings to have breakfast with my husband. I'm still married, 35 years, it didn't,
good for you.
You know, but I would have spent some time with him. I would have spent some time with a girlfriend, which is what in my life really went when I was working and raising three kids. I would have read a book. I would have maybe done some volunteer work. I didn't have to be there every single Saturday. And I think that's the girls, because my practice was mostly girls, who said to me, please help me get a hobby for my mother besides me. That's what they meant. They felt like everything was oversight. How'd you, at the end, why'd you miss that goal? Or couldn't you have done that differently? Or arguing with the coach, or cheering too loud, or just being there. Nobody likes to be watched every minute. And I think that ends up being a very unappealing picture of adulthood. You work all week long, and then you do child-centered activities all weekend long. And so, you know, what's the cool thing about growing up and being an adult?
Let me get Janine from Winmore to join us on Radio Times. Janine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
It's a terrific topic. I'm a psychotherapist, a clinical social worker based in Winmore in Philadelphia, and I've been running support groups for new moms since about 2006, although I've been doing a lot of postpartum support work with moms for longer than that. And I just want to go back to that point that you made a few minutes ago about not feeling judged and feeling like you can just talk to somebody. The groups that I run, it's really heartbreaking, actually, these wonderful women who have these beautiful, healthy babies coming in just feeling, and I'm not talking about depressed necessarily, moms, postpartum depression, clinically depressed. These are really just a normative group of women, but they feel so stressed out and so much pressure to have had the perfect pregnancy, the perfect labor and delivery, and now this, you know, the perfect baby, that they don't understand that there's a range of what's normal. Mm-hmm. And if you subscribe to certain listservs online, you'll get stuff in your inbox every day, which there are a lot of these websites for women who are just adjusting to motherhood, and they'll tell you something in your inbox every day. Your baby is this week, this many weeks today. They should be rolling over.
Oh, dear.
They should be smiling in this particular way. And so women come in like, oh, my God, what have I done? I've done something wrong. So there's this enormous link between maternal performance in some way and their child's ability to thrive or succeed, whatever that looks like, even in infancy.
Well, that's fascinating, Janine.
What my group gives people is a chance to be real with each other instead of acting like we've got it all together in this sort of mommy competition.
Well, you know what, Janine, let me just stop you. You raise a really good point, and I'm looking at the clock here. I want to give Madeline Levine a chance to weigh in. Madeline, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, this reminds me, I don't know if you saw the article in The Atlantic called The Data-Driven Parent, and there are these devices now from the day you bring your child home from the hospital where you monitor every single move, poop, turnover, everything they do, and I'm horrified at it because it is, and the reason is they say they want you to be able to, quote, debug your baby. You know, there is money to be made in all of these crazy things that are supposed to make you better and your child more perfect. There is no money to be made in saying, just hang out, hold your baby, love them, and play with them. And the cynic in me really does believe that a lot of this is economically driven.
Oh, interesting. Janine, I appreciate that, the call to Radio Times. Madeline, just one final comment that I got from your book, which is that too many parents can't stand to see their own children unhappy. I can relate to that to some degree, but why is that a problem?
Right. So I said, if you can't stand to see your kid unhappy, you're in the wrong business, because, which isn't quite as harsh as it sounds. Look, how does a toddler learn how to walk? You know, she takes a few steps, she falls down. She takes a few more steps, she falls down. You don't get hysterical. You encourage her to keep going. You smile, you clap, and that kid will fall down 100 times before she can walk. And that, to me, is the paradigm of good parenting and child development, that we understand that our kids have to fail in order to continue to develop. And to the extent to which we can tolerate that, and, you know, the baby cries out for a minute right when she falls down, not so much out of hurt but out of surprise most of the time, we have to be able to tolerate that. Otherwise, we end up, there was a great New Yorker cartoon with a obviously affluent-looking mom pushing her grown son in a wheelchair. and she says, obviously, to somebody, well, of course he can walk, but thank God he doesn't have to.
Wow.
And, we cripple our children by not allowing them to learn the coping skills that come with a failure, picking yourself up and trying again.
Well, on that note, Madeline Levine, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
No problem. And the book is called Teach Your Children Well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. And coming